So I'd like to offer some reflections tonight on the themes of suffering, dispassion, and ways of looking. So in the chant that Catherine introduced yesterday, that we've been chanting now for a few days, there's a section that goes: association with the disliked is dukkha. Separation from the liked is dukkha. And not attaining one's wishes is dukkha. So I'm wondering, it's the evening of day two on retreat, whether how that resonates, or whether there's something recognizable in that, in those lines. Does it feel like it rings true, or there's something there? A few nods and smiles. So this word dukkha is one of the most basic or central concepts in the Buddha Dharma, in the teachings. If we just sort of go over some of the basics, its meaning is often translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness, that which is difficult to be with, unpleasant or uncomfortable. And really sort of referring to a whole spectrum of experiences, from grief and pain and loss, anxiety, to physical pain or discomfort, to more kind of mundane boredom or disinterest, or just that feeling of wanting a little bit of something else, to things that are actually even more subtle, that we wouldn't necessarily consider suffering in the ordinary sense. And to me, as I reflect on this, it feels like there's something quite grounding something quite earthy in the way of orienting the teachings around this concept, that this forms a kind of a basis for the Dharma. It feels like it's kind of an honest acknowledgement of, you know, there is this as well in our experience, that there is this, the difficult. And at the same time that there's space for this within the teachings and within the practice, it feels like it sort of creates a space for that to be okay, for that to be acknowledged, that it's part of the human condition. And to me, it feels like there's a kind of a compassionate depth in that acknowledgement, that there's some, you can kind of feel it, touch something, or I can feel it touch something. That there's this sort of acknowledgement of things can be difficult, things can be hard. And at the same time, that within all the ideals of the Dharma, that we don't have to be perfect in it. That there is this space for the acknowledgement of imperfection or difficulty. And a kind of an honoring of suffering, or kind of seeing it. And at the same time, because it's such a central part of the teachings, it's sort of saying whatever we may be struggling with is a valid starting point for our practice. So wherever, whatever is going on, whatever the difficulty is, we can it's kind of an opening a door that we can practice with this. We can find a way in through this. I think Catherine was on the opening night, or perhaps yesterday, referring to this sense of, often we might have a thought of, if only this thing wasn't here, then my retreat could really flower, or my practice could really flower. So there's a sense of, for me, within this teaching of dukkha, of suffering, of difficulty, it's kind of reminding us that that's not so, that the difficulty is actually the first step. Can be helpful to remember in the beginning of the retreat, when things can feel more hard. And of course, at the same time, there's more to the Dharma than just there is suffering. Luckily, it doesn't finish there. So the chant goes on to identify some of the causes of suffering, or point them out. I don't know if you've noticed: attachment to form, attachment to feeling, perception, formations, and sense consciousness. So I'm not actually going to unpack that so much here. It's the five skandhas or khandhas, the five different areas of experience, or five constituents of experience that make up everything that we actually experience. But the principle of it, the idea of attachment, you probably recognize this as a familiar idea, in the way that it's expressed through the Four Noble Truths, another kind of very central teaching in the Dharma, that there is suffering and that there's a cause to suffering, grasping or holding on or attachment, wishing things to be otherwise, the cause for it, desire. And also that there is an ending or a cessation of suffering through the possibility of letting go. That it's possible for us to practice in a way that alleviates, or we can begin to relax some of the grasping, some of the attachment. Finally, the whole path of practice that has that as its direction, the letting go. So I'd like to say, sometimes it might be easy to sort of overlook the Four Noble Truths as this thing of it's a basic teaching, you know, it can feel very familiar, and I know that there's people who've heard it a lot and who've read a lot and it's familiar. So there can be a sense sometimes of like, oh, I've heard this before, I know this. It's familiar. But I feel like on retreat there's a different dimension, or there's a kind of a question of how deeply do we know it? Like, do we recognize it on an intellectual level? And what is it to kind of, for me, the Dharma is also an embodied knowledge. So do I really know it in my bones? What does it mean for it to go deeper somehow? If I'm just saying that, if it feels like there's a sense of it being familiar. So this teaching on grasping and suffering and liberation, is one of the key teachings that's really pointing directly to the heart of our experience. So it's not just some removed psychological theory. It's not somehow separate from this moment and this retreat. It's something that we can explore directly in our experience and through our meditation practice over these days. What does it mean to become familiar with grasping? And what does it mean to find ways of letting go, of relaxing that grasping, relaxing that attachment? How does one go about doing that? Of course, it's easy to talk about letting go, and it's a nice idea. But it's not something that we can just choose to do. If we could just choose to let go, perhaps we wouldn't need these retreats. It would be a kind of a shame. So, in that sense, perhaps we're lucky. But what I'm wanting to say, maybe it's obvious already, but our grasping or our attachment it's not like a volitional thing. It's not coming out of our choice. It's not operating on the rational level of the mind. It's somehow more ingrained in the psyche, or it's more embedded in the consciousness as a feature of the consciousness. And also in the body, actually. And so this is where the meditation practices themselves come in. Practices that can support a letting go, that can facilitate the heart to let go of this grasping, to ease that grasping. So one set of practices that we'll be actually exploring and unfolding throughout this retreat over the next days are the three characteristics, the three ways of looking, probably quite familiar to many of you, perhaps new to some others. So essentially these are ways of looking, or ways of attending, ways of relating to our experience that facilitate, that make possible a letting go, that lead to dispassion, that lead to ease, that lead to freedom. So I'll say a few words about each of them and how to practice, and we'll continue to unpack them over the days, so you don't have to sort of remember it all now, but just hopefully this will be a useful framework or overview. So the first of the three characteristics is in Pali anicca, impermanence, transience. So again, something that's very familiar to us on an intellectual level, that we know that things change. But as a meditation practice, we're sort of bringing our direct attention to the changing nature of experience, to the changing nature of phenomena. So whatever is happening in current experience, we can bring in this way of seeing, this reflection, this too shall change, this too will change, this is subject to change. And just as a kind of a quiet seeing or quiet reflection, or sometimes it can be even a wordless reflection of just noticing change simply as it's occurring, on the level of the body, of emotions, mind states, thoughts, anything that's coming up, any beautiful or difficult experience. This too will pass. And as we begin to practice this way, a part of the awareness is also noticing, what are the effects of this practice? What are the effects of this meditation? What does it do to the heart? What does it do to the psyche, to the mind? What happens in our experience? So this is often an important question, or whatever kind of meditation practice we're doing, that there's a part of there's the doing of the practice, and then there's a part of the mind that's kind of looking at what's happening as I'm doing this. What are the sort of knock-on effects of this practice, whatever it may be. So typically, if one continues to pursue this kind of attention of noticing change or of reflecting on the impermanence of whatever is coming up, you can notice it leading to a kind of a letting go. So if there is some tightness in the experience around something that feels difficult, if one pursues this seeing of like, oh, this is going to change, this will change, and ease comes through that. There's a letting go that comes through that. That's actually can be quite palpable, can be felt in the arena of the body, in the psyche, in the heart, as a kind of a relaxing or a letting go. So that's something that you can be aware of as you pursue this practice. What's the effect on the field of the body that we've been looking at over the past few days, cultivating this sensitive attention, this gatheredness. So it also leads to a kind of a dispassion. You can notice this. Perhaps it's not immediately obvious. A kind of a the mind, we know the mind can kind of quite easily obsess over different kinds of things. This is like a feature of the mind for probably very many of us. And just noticing, bringing in this perception of transience, of noticing change, of reminding oneself of like whatever this mind state that is happening, this too will pass, this too will change. The mind begins to let go. It becomes a little bit less interested. There's a kind of a movement of stepping back. And in the stepping back, the object also begins to fall away a little further, becomes pacified in a way. We become more okay with meeting the difficult. It becomes easier to hold, easier to meet through this knowledge, through this direct knowledge of its impermanence. And this understanding or this knowing, this seeing, like, oh, I can step back from this, becomes a little bit easier, leads the mind to equanimity. Perhaps not like immediately, but over time, as we continue to pursue, continue to look, the mind begins to settle more. There's a quieting down of experience. So in that sense, just this simple noting of impermanence, of bringing attention to that, that's actually a support for samadhi as well. It's kind of a natural samadhi through the letting go, through the changing of the relationship, that we become more at ease, the mind becomes a little bit more settled. So this is actually quite a lot of things already. So we can notice all of this, that there's just through this simple act of noticing whatever is happening in my experience, this too is subject to change. As we're practicing in this way, we can see, oh, how does it radiate? How does it ripple out? What are the effects of the practice throughout the being, in the heart, in the psyche? How does it affect the experience itself? And all of this, all of that I've mentioned, it begins to reveal also how our way of looking, how our way of attending conditions the experience. So often we have this sense of experience as something objective, something inherently out there, something real, that you know, that it's sort of assailing me if it's a difficult experience. We begin to become aware that, oh, when I practice this way of looking, it actually directly affects the experience itself. It affects the state of the mind, the state of the consciousness, and the object itself. We become aware of this deep dependency between the way of looking, between how I'm attending to my experience and how the experience responds. There's a kind of a connection, an invisible string that we're not often aware of. between the object and our gaze. And this is actually, you know, the Four Noble Truths, that the suffering is dependent on the grasping. The difficulty or the suffering is, another way of saying that is, the difficulty or the suffering is also dependent on the way of looking. That in the way of looking, in the way of attending, in the way of relating, there's a grasping or there's a holding on. So again, this is like often framed as one of these very basic insights, but to me it often feels like, oh, there's actually a huge depth here, even after years of practice and having seen it. It still kind of surprises me, like, oh, this suffering, it depends on how I'm looking. It depends on how I'm attending to it, and that there's this possibility of liberation or freedom through practicing a more skillful way of seeing. So the second characteristic, as they usually in this order, is actually dukkha, so suffering or unsatisfactoriness, as it's often translated within the context of the three characteristics. And usually the way that it's framed is, because all phenomena, if we practice with this impermanence, we begin to notice all phenomena, everything in experience is just flowing and changing. We become aware of this constant flow or pass of a kind of a flow, a river of experience, body sensations, emotions, thoughts, mind states, perceptions, sounds, sights, sense experience. We become aware of how it's constantly changing, and like from one moment to the next. So if you think about this moment, it's quite different from all the other moments throughout the day, and all of those other moments are now gone. They're not coming back in exactly the same way. So kind of building on that, because everything is constantly changing, nothing through sense experience can actually deliver happiness. Can deliver true satisfaction. So we begin to notice, oh, you know, we're sort of invested in this project often in our lives of looking for satisfaction, looking for happiness, looking for meaningfulness through this changing flow of experience. And it begins to look like not such a great project once had a look at this impermanence for a while. It doesn't look like such a great way of looking for the depth of happiness. So this is what the second characteristic builds on, and we can use it as a kind of a lens or as a way of looking that further develops or aids a letting go that supports this dispassion. So just in our experience, whatever's coming up, we can meditatively perhaps use a gentle label saying, oh, unsatisfactory, to kind of counter our tendency to look for satisfaction in whatever experience. So whatever's happening in experience, whether it be a mind state or a beautiful meditative state, we can just kind of drop in, oh, this too is unsatisfactory. This too is going to change. It's not worth investing in the same way. And again, this isn't kind of like, we're not saying this as the ultimate truth of experience. It's more of an experiment that we're engaging in. So we'll see what happens when we engage with this way of looking. What are the sort of ripples through experience? What's the knock-on effect? What happens to perception? This is kind of more, for me at least, and I think for all of us, the sort of the project of this style of practice, noticing what are the effects when I engage in a different way of looking. What happens to my perception? What happens to my experience? And again, noticing all of the things that I mentioned before, primarily noticing any sense of release if we're working with something difficult or if there's some difficulty in our experience, noticing how does this perception of unsatisfactoriness, how does it affect my suffering if I notice this? We can become conscious of I've been wanting this experience to be satisfying on some level. And so it's a kind of a stepping back from that investment. I don't know how pessimistic it sounds. Maybe a little bit, you know, but it's a worthwhile exploration. It actually can lead to quite a lot of release, quite a lot of a beautiful letting go and just kind of allowing. It's a way of disentangling ourselves from the experience. So we're often sort of invested or tangled in this sense of looking for, just one moment, we're often in this project of looking for or trying to get satisfaction out of our experience. So this is a way of exploring what happens if we don't invest ourselves in that way. Is it okay if I take questions right at the end? And then, yeah, thank you. And again, this sense of release, as I was saying before, it can be felt in the field of the body. So as we're doing this practice, we're sort of sensitive to the field of the whole body, aware of what's happening there and noticing, oh, how does this feel? What's the quality of it? And that becomes a kind of a compass for the practice. So if it leads to a sense of release, if it leads to a sense of letting go or a sense of ease, we can kind of tell that we're somehow on the right track, that's actually the directionality of all of these practices of ways of looking that lead to letting go or lead to dispassion. There's some kind of ease, some kind of softening, some kind of relaxation. That's the direction. Or another way of practicing with these with this characteristic of dukkha this is from a teacher, Rob Berbea, who I've practiced with, who's a mentor to both Sampo and myself, and also a good friend of Catherine's. He talks about using this perspective of an attitude of holy disinterest or holy discontent. So that there's some kind of stepping back, that there's a kind of a shedding of phenomena, just seeing like, oh, it's just phenomena, it's just like it cannot satisfy, kind of taking that kind of perspective into our way of looking, relating to it as something that we can just let fall away, that there's a kind of a skillful disinterest in relationship to our experience. It's just like, it's just experience. It's only phenomena. And again, we're not sort of suggesting, I'm not suggesting that this is, our attitude to all of life. But it's something that we can play with, when we come on retreat, and we can play with it and we can explore. Oh, what does this do to my perception? What does it do to my experience? What happens when I engage with this style of looking? Things begin to fall away. How does it feel? How does it impact the heart? It's in a way a way of practicing dispassion. One of the key themes or one of the threads that we'll be exploring here on this retreat. And also, as I was saying, the question is, what are the results of this way of looking? So as we're practicing this kind of dispassion, we can begin to notice, it tends to lead to a quieting down of experience, to a lesser building of it, or to an unbinding, as is sometimes the word or the language, and unfabrication of experience. So we can, sometimes it's talked about how experience is fabricated, And through these practices, we can kind of get a sense of it, that, you know, some emotions can be really big, some narratives, some stories, then they can become like so real and so big. And then later we notice it sort of subsides and it's like, oh, that wasn't quite as real in the way that it felt. These practices begin to reveal that we can adopt a stance of holy disinterest or discontentment and just let it fall away, let it shed, let it kind of let go of it. And we notice that this leads to an unbinding or can lead to a letting go of or a fading away of experience. And sometimes I think many of us actually have these experiences, but we don't quite recognize them as such. So we're not used to thinking in these ways. So it's like these experiences are actually quite easy to overlook, which is why we're wanting to highlight them. So, you know, earlier this morning, as Sampo was giving the instructions, in a more kind of samadhied direction, I think you use the metaphor of the kind of poetic metaphor or the experience of small knots becoming undone in the body as one relates to it with ease or with kindness or, you know, exhaling. And that's something that we can feel or we can experience. And the sense of the body begins to change. It's like something becomes a little bit unbound. The body loses some of the substantiality or the sense of materiality begins to change. It's a little bit more fluid or liquid with the breath. Or can be even more subtle, or a sense of peace comes. And it's like, oh, there's this softness of peace that pervades. This is all part of the spectrum of fading, or the spectrum of unbinding or unfabrication. Or then simply the mind just quieting a little bit. You know, sometimes the story of the mind or the thinking mind, it goes a little bit more quiet, it fades away. And this is also another aspect of another level, or one aspect of unbinding or unfabrication. Things are a little bit less built. We're kind of like, you know, you're walking somewhere and you become aware of, oh, it's so quiet. And it's like all of that storying has disappeared. It's like that's not being fabricated in the same way. And again, you know, the point of all this isn't sort of to permanently get to hang out in places of, or in inner spaces of less fabrication. But as we practice, we can become more familiar with a broader range of experience, of knowing like, oh, now it's really built up. There's like a very strong sense of self and a strong emotion and a strong sense of narrative and reality in the world. And recognizing, and that's fine. It's like, it's really fine for us to inhabit that, and it's useful, and it's like, it's natural. It's unavoidable. And then other times, as we sit down, the experience can quiet down, the conditions come together, and something dissolves a little bit. And it's like, oh, not quite so much story now, or the body begins to soften, and the knots begin to come undone. There's a bit more peace, and it's like, oh, it's a little bit softer, it's a little bit less fabricated now. And noticing how does my way of looking, how does my way of attending, how does my way of relating affect all of that? We have quite a lot of input into that. We can practice, we can become more skilled with the malleability of perception, with the way that our experience comes alive or is shaped. All of this is an exploration into that. And finally, the third characteristic, anatta, not self. Really, a way of letting go of our tendency to identify with experience. So we have this intuitive intuitive sense or intuitive impulse to identify with everything that happens within our, almost everything that happens within our field of experience. So I don't know whether this is a familiar idea to everyone. I'm sure it is to many people. So what does this mean? It kind of means that if I think of an example from, say, an environment like this where one is engaging in meditation practice and then the mind wanders, and it can be a sitting where the mind wanders a lot, how easy it is for then to draw a conclusion about the self. We become identified with this wandering mind and we think, you know, I'm so restless. I'm such a restless person. We become sort of identified with this one faculty of mind, the natural tendency of the mind to wander, and become kind of build our identity for a little while around that. And then that becomes like, I'm a bad meditator. And that continues to sort of build our sense of identity through this intuitive identification. And to keep sort of drawing conclusions from this. So, you know, it can be restlessness or tiredness or whatever, or then it's a great meditation and then it's like, ah, maybe I'm a great, you know, I'm the next possible, whatever. Perhaps I'll be awakened at the end of this retreat. And then it's like another kind of self-sense is born through that process of identification. And again, identification is like another natural feature of consciousness. So we're not interested in eradicating it in any way, but it's just becoming familiar with that process. Noticing like, oh, now there's identification. This is how it feels. And with this way of looking, with this anatta perspective, we practice a conscious disidentification with experience. So again, building a little bit on this sense of impermanence, we look, we see everything in the field of the experience is changing. It just keeps coming and going. And that actually makes it possible to realize or makes it possible to notice none of these things that are changing in my experience can be me or mine. We're just seeing that they're arising from this vast network of causes and conditions. And we can consciously begin to disidentify skillfully with experience, explore this non-selfhood. So, you know, if and again, we'll be talking and exploring this more through guided meditations and so on through the retreat. But body sensations, for example, noticing how they're changing as I'm aware of my body here. You know, there's body sensations arising from the contact between the mat and the weight of the body against the earth or against the floor. And kind of seeing, oh, those are born from the causes and conditions. The body is giving rise to them. And if I shift my leg, then the sensations change. They go away. And it's kind of like that can be an insight or a doorway. They can't really be me or mine. They're just born out of the conditions of the body and the floor meeting, like having a physical body like this. And we can sort of bring in this noting as we're observing the sensations of the body, reminding ourselves, not me, not mine. And that can serve as a skillful way of beginning to dislodge or play with or question our typical way of identifying with experience. I thought there would be a lot more to say about this, but I feel like it's more useful to unpack it over the next few days. But I thought I'd finish with an Ajahn Chah quote, the Thai master who was in a way one of the founders of the forest tradition or the monasteries that have been established here in the West or in the UK and other places in Europe and America, that Catherine also was referring to yesterday, I think, in that the chants are coming from his monasteries. So he's yeah, he's a now deceased teacher, but you know, there's a lot of teachings available by him, and he's great because he has this ability to really condense the teachings into a very kind of simple and lucid form. So I'll just read you this part. It's actually from a book called No Ajahn Chah. When the teaching story around that, I just
know,
yeah, N-O, yes, exactly. So someone came to ask him a question about him or you know, who is Ajahn Chah, and he just replied, "There is no Ajahn Chah," which is again like one perspective into this teaching of anatta. That wasn't the quote. The quote's longer. Okay, it wasn't that condensed, but that's you get two for the price of one. So this is Ajahn Chah speaking. It is so easy once you understand. It is so simple and direct. When pleasant things arise, understand that they are empty. When unpleasant things arise, see that they are not yours. They pass away. Don't relate to them as being you or see yourself as the owner of them. You think that papaya tree is yours, then why don't you feel hurt when it is cut down? If you can understand this, then the mind comes into balance. When the mind comes into balance, then this is the correct path, the correct teaching of the Buddha, and the teaching that leads to liberation. So let's sit quietly for a few minutes.